Welcome to the Indisposable Podcast, produced by Upstream and supported this season by Patagonia. I'm your host, Brookine Gatewood. Thanks for joining for another episode celebrating solutions to plastic pollution. My guest today is Diane Wilson. And Diane's story is a great one for all of you listeners out there who are thinking you don't know how to get involved in this issue of plastic pollution, but it's driving you nuts in some way, shape, or form. And Diane is someone who had nothing to do with activism from a career perspective. She's a shrimp fisherwoman by trade. And she got involved about 30 years ago, actually, because the place that she loved and grew up for generations of her family was being polluted by industrial chemical plants in the area. And the bay that her livelihood relied on was being polluted as well. And so Diane went from being a shrimp fisherwoman to a retired shrimp fisherwoman and hellraiser activist, as she's sometimes known as. And she has, over the course of the last 30 years, truly raised hell in Texas and with some of these companies chaining her body to chemical plants and engaging in civil disobedience, hunger strikes, sinking her own boat in a protest at one point to raise awareness and change the game and change the conversation around what is and isn't allowable and acceptable when it comes to industrial pollution. And so Diane, for me, is a personal hero. I've been following her for my entire career, and she's the person I think of when I think it's too hard and I don't know if I have the courage. I think of Diane. And so it is just an honor to get to speak with her. She's also a co-founder of Code Pink. She's won all sorts of awards for her courageous activism. There's a documentary about her called Texas Gold. She's got a number of books out, including one called Unreasonable Woman, which tells the original story of her transition from shrimping to activism. And today we're going to talk with her about this really exciting victory that happened just in the last few months, where in collaboration with folks from Break Free from Plastic, the citizens of Texas were able to bring a lawsuit against Formosa Plastic for illegal dumping of pellets into the bay, and won. So we want to celebrate this victory with her and also talk a little bit about her many years of experience and wisdom that she has to offer with all of us who care and want to do something to address the injustices we see all around us. So Diane, it's totally an honor to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Let's start by just hearing a little bit about the story of how you got into this activism work in the first place, the transitioning from working on the bay to working for the bay.
Well, it's a 30-year flesh out because, I was a fourth-generation shrimper. I had my own shrimp boat, a 42-foot boat, and I dearly loved being the captain on board that boat. And I was, at the time, I dipped my toe into the environmental activism. I was working at a fish house because shrimping had really fell off. So I was running a fish house, and I had all these different boats, and I would unload the shrimp, and I would load them ice, you know, and haul the shrimp off to Louisiana usually. And I had one shrimper that kind of threw this pickle at me, and it was the first time the toxic release inventory ever came out. This was 1989. It was the first time it was made public. And our county, which is tiny, at that time it was probably 16,000 people in the entire county. And we were number one in the nation for toxic disposal to the land and had half the waste generated in the state of Texas in our little county.
Wow.
So that's where it started. And it just so happened that the company that made us number one was Alcoa, with their mercury contamination, all that. But it just so happened that that was when Formosa Plastic decided to do like a $3 billion chemical expansion. It was the biggest one Texas had ever had, and it was the biggest in the United States in 10 years. And it all happened at this one period of time, and it was like a snowball rolling to hell from there. Been rolling ever since, and this is 30 years. And believe it or not, this action is the first time I ever felt I really had justice delivered. It was a long wait. It's been a long wait.
Wow. Yeah. So before we jump into the recent win, I want to talk a little bit for our audience. I'm sure many of you listening feel like, oh, what could I do? I'm just one person, right? But Diane is one person who has made a tremendous impact. And you know, you may not have felt that sense of justice until this recent win, but you've also had a lot of high impact moments where you personally, through your actions, were able to really change a lot of trajectories of polluting companies. Thinking about when you changed yourself to the Dow chemical plant, for example. So are you willing to share a couple of the highlights along the way and how you went from being a shrimp fisherwoman to a suddenly expert on legal issues and activism?
Well, it began because I am just like, I think, most people out there, and I came from a very small rural county. And like I said, I'm a high school graduate. I had five kids. The place we're from was very low economic rung, extremely low. But this was my home. My family had been in this area for 120 years. So I had a real strong sense of place. I mean, if you hear about Native Americans talking about the great father or the mountains and with personalities and the sea, and it's like, that is what it was like for me. It was like family, and that was alive, and it wasn't just a resource or a job. It was You were around all this living, breathing community of beings, whether they're human or water or lightning or tornadoes or hurricanes. But anyway, when you start fighting these chemical plants, especially down here in Texas, it's like you run up against the power of the corporate citizenship, and they influence the legislature, and they influence the local politicians, the city halls, the mayors, the county commissioners, and people really get PO'd about you speaking up. And with me way back when, it was like they really got perturbed because I was a woman and dared speak up. You know, it was like men were a little bit more allowed to do it, but I mean, I just doubly pissed them off. And so you have no one. You literally, I didn't have family. I didn't have community. The fishermen was so apathetic. I mean, they were on their way down. They felt like the nails were in the coffin, and you couldn't fight City Hall. And every time they would see me coming to try to get them to be involved in fighting for BOSA or fighting for the permit, they were like, you know, you can't fight City Hall. Don't come looking at me. And so I suddenly started realizing it was either you fight that appears to be a real hard, almost losing battle, or you just give up. You give up your home. And I refused to do it. I was like, I drew a line in the sand. And it's like, they are not getting that water. I mean, I drew it, and I'm like, they're not going to get it. And so first thing I thought of, off the top of my head, I thought of a hunger strike. And the thought of the hunger strike scared me so bad that I knew if I did not do it that day, if I didn't call up the media and say, I'm beginning a hunger strike, that by the next day, I would have talked myself out of it. And so I started doing civil disobedience, and I was amazed at the difference that it made. It's like it shuffled the energy, and suddenly things could happen. And I got many surprising small wins.
Yeah.
And it was on this civil disobedience. And so I have did hunger strikes. I have climbed chemical tires and chained myself. I have, I think probably one of my most daring ones is I took my own shrimp boat out and proceeded to sink it on top of Formosa's discharge pipe.
Wow.
And believe it or not, that one got a just a phenomenal result from it. One that I never even believed was possible, and you couldn't have even planned it. But it was like taking my boat out to sink it was the day I got the shrimpers on my side and involved in an action that would actually could have cost them all their boats.
Wow. I have chills just hearing that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what I have learned is, one, it's that you have to trust your instinct for what you believe is right, and you have to step out there with intention. And I think when you do that, I really believe it's like a key to the universe, and that it changes things.
You know, one of the reasons that you've been such a personal hero to me is that message right there. And I saw you speak at Bioneers when I was 22, maybe. And I was, you know, fresh into environmental activism myself. And you were, I think, on parole, and you walked onto the stage and you looked around, you said, "I'm not here if anybody asks," you know, and as you'd done some civil disobedience action but then, you know, somebody asked a question. I remember this so distinctly of you, and they said, you know, "How do you know what to do next? Like you said, you this isn't your training, right?" And you said, and I can't mimic your accent, but you said, "Well, I smell my fear and I head straight towards it."
That's true. That's true. That's absolutely the fact. Because it is. When you really come to a place where it's genuine and it's scary. It's a very scary place, and you know you're at the edge and you might just step off, and you will smell the fear. That's when I can always tell I'm on the right path.
Yeah, it's amazing. So tell us a little bit more about this recent win where you got a sense of justice. I know some of our listeners might know about it, but some might know anything. So tell us the story of this nurdle issue in Texas.
Well, it's real interesting because I'm a fisherwoman, and I don't know anything about chemical plants or that whole scene, but because I have been fighting Formosa so long and I have kept at it, eventually when workers either get injured or they really get fed up with what they're doing, they want to tell someone. So they can't go to their company. Formosa will fire you. You come to them with an environmental or safety issue, and it's like, you can bet you're going to get yourself fired. You can't go to the local VA. You can't go to the sheriff. You can't go to the county commissioners. You can't go to the city hall. It's because of all of the strong economic ties, you know, and I've got a million. It's not just say so. I mean, it's examples these workers have told me that tried to do it. You can't go to OSHA. You can't go to TNRCC for sure. You can't go to EPA. And so eventually these guys would come to me. I'm last one on the list. And, And they would tell me all of these things that were really going on inside the plant, and not only the stories, but often they had documents. And one of the workers that I ended up talking to had been a whistleblower. He had worked in utilities, which is wastewater, and he had become a whistleblower until the FBI, EPA, TCEQ, the whole crew, and that they were manipulating the wastewater. And, you know, like how you sample it, how you test it, what are you putting out in the water, what are you, you know, and it was this, he said Formosa was manipulating it. They were cheating, literally cheating. Mm-hmm. And so he got himself fired for sure. And I had heard through the grapevine about him being out there, but he was extremely suspicious of people. And then one day he called me and he wanted to talk to me about something. So I met him in a very faraway place. No, none of the workers talk in the county. We got to get out of the county. And so I met him in a beer joint, and it was called The Hideout, I believe. And it was, and so I went in there, and there was this old worker with a cowboy hat, boots, and the first thing he did was he checked my purse to see if I was wired. I don't know who he thought I might have worked for. But anyway, this guy was the one who told me about all of the pellets. And matter of fact, he said he had took the FBI and TCEQ, which is Texas State Environmental Agency there, and he mm-hmm. took them out because he was telling them about the pellets that were all over the place and the powder that was all over the place and that it was coming out the main outfall into Lavaca Bay where all the shrimpers and oystermen are. And he said they went out there and there was an island out there and it was covered in pellets. And the FBI took a picture of it and took the picture and did nothing. And they also did nothing about the wastewater manipulation. I mean, it all just disappeared.
I want to interrupt and just ask you, so what does it mean that these pellets are getting out into the bay? What do you guys know about the chemical hazards and what that means for water quality?
What it means is these pellets and powder, you use ethylene dichloride, you use vinyl chloride, you use benzene, you use catalyst, you add, they have phthalates in them. And so they're a chemical manufactured product. And because of Formosa's sloppy housekeeping and poorly designed conduit for stormwater and to handle all of this stuff is ending out into the bay, the powder and the pellets. And what you have found is this enormous, it's probably started, maybe it's been 26 years now they've been doing it. And so you have this chemically produced plastic product that the fish are eating. The oystermen have said they find it in the oysters that they're shucking. It's in the ecosystem. Who the Samuel knows what it's doing to the sediment and the whole ecosystem and the shores and the algae. And we have a mercury superfund site, and we've already tested the pellets, and they're picking up the mercury. So the mercury is being spread, dispersed all over the bay, and you have fishermen who go out there. You have sportsmen who go out there. You have oystermen who are out there. You have fin fishermen who are out there. And, you know, and they're just now finding out the health impacts of possibilities of what all this can mean when you have marine life that is taking this in and is being exposed to it.
Yeah, what you just said about the mercury, where not everybody knows this, but those little plastic pellets, they're kind of like sponges for other chemicals, right?
That's right.
So whatever's in the water, you have all these little sponges that have spilled out into the ecosystem, collecting it, and then fish eat it. And
those pellets, especially when they've been out there a little bit and take on some of the stuff, it smells like food to the fish. And they just gobble it up, and the birds too.
So this is bad. So Formosa's
being
sloppy, like you said, with their production, and they're not doing a good job of keeping whatever's happening in the factory in the factory. And you have this worker that was able to help you guys get some visibility into what's going on. And then I understand this is unique because it's really been a citizen-driven process to collect the evidence, which is unusual, right?
Yeah. You know, a clean water suit is usually federal government or the state, but when they don't do it, there's a, you know, a loophole where a citizen can file suit. And what's really different is that these are not clean water violations that were already on the book, like the state's or the EPA's book, and that they just weren't forced. They were not even on the book. We got our own evidence. And I do know we started when I was fighting Formosa's permit, and we brought up the pellets and the plastic, and the state, TCEQ, did not want to go into the pellets. So they said, oh, well, if they discharge them, it's a violation and they'll report it. And that's what Formosa said too. Yeah, well, let's don't talk about pellets in a hearing, because if we discharge them, then we're going to report it. And I was like, well, really, let's just see. So we started collecting January 2016, and it's been a daily thing for almost 4 years.
Wow.
And we've got over 2,500 samples, probably 7,000 videos and photographs, and we just collected ourselves.
So tell us just a little bit about what it's been like to get all this evidence and gather the citizens and go to court in this citizen-run trial. Like, how, what's it been like on the back end to coordinate all this?
Wow. Well, it's, I've always said when I speak sometimes, it's a good thing I'm kind of ignorant or I'm not well educated, because you don't know what you can't do. So, you know, and if someone knew all the many things and how long it takes and how long we would be at it, I mean, some people, I was like, oh, my God, you know, that's just too much. I'm not going to do that. But we just started and we just kept at it. And it's been 4 years. It's been 4 years. It has not been easy. We have not had support. We have not had funding. Most of the time we, I think our last count, it was like $15. And actually after we, I went to a conference with Break Free from Plastic, which I had never heard of before. Mm-hmm. And it was like, whoa, I had no idea that was out there and that type of information. And it was like a world library just opened for me, and all about plastic. It was amazing. That was an amazing door that opened for me. But it's been a very learning experience. But we did it one day at a time, one day at a time.
Yeah. I love hearing that the Break Free from Plastic group has felt really helpful, because that's the beauty of movements, right?
They really had. I mean, hearing the plastics plant, and I was like, the things that we were doing, it was like, how can you stop this from happening? And you just do what you see, you know, because I don't have degrees in biology or chemistry or plastics engineering or any of that stuff. And you just see it, so you want to stop it, so you do. You just start collecting,
mm-hmm.
you know. And when I got with Break Free from Plastic, I was like, whoa. And also knowing how much was going out there in the world, and when you're kind of isolated, you don't know about that stuff. And So I give a lot of credit to Greg Freed from Plastic. I really do.
Yeah, it's so great to see. I mean, as far as movements go, right, there's the coordinating nationally and internationally and sharing information and all that, which Break Free does, but also the connecting with local efforts like what you've been involved in.
Yep. It really, really has been. And I'm amazed at the great people I've been in contact with. It's been astounding, really.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of another point of inspiration for those who want to do something in their own local areas, wherever you live. I'm sure there's examples of local pollution that you could work on and working on it locally and connecting with the larger national and international efforts that have a lot of information and resources to share.
That is true. You know, I always like to quote with Eleanor Roosevelt. At least they said she said it. And they say, you do what you can with what you have where you are. And that's what you do. I mean, you don't have to travel all the way to Washington, D.C. You don't have to go travel 200 miles on the other side of the country or go over to Europe or whatever. I mean, it's right there. All you got to do is look around and by gosh, you will see it.
Yeah, exactly. And so you guys got a ruling on this. It was early July. And the judge ruled that, yes, it had been illegal dumping. And are you still waiting on the exact fine amount, or has that been decided yet?
No. We go to trial October 28th. It'll be a week of trial. And we will discuss the penalties and how many days. I mean, the judge in this ruling brought up 1,800 days of violation. And I know we are asking $168 million. That's what we think for all those violations and for not reporting. And also, they saved $42 million by not doing any of it, you know?
And where does that money go?
It goes to the federal government. I know a lot of people locally, they think, oh, we were putting it in our pockets and we're doing it for the money. And it's like, nope, this goes all to the federal government.
And then they decide if they're going to do a Superfund cleanup or anything like that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely, because there is a lot out there. It really, really is. I mean, you can walk out there in the water and stir up the pellets. We have a couple of guys that go out there. They have a couple of dogs, and the dogs like to play in the water. And they call them the pellet dogs. Go out there, and those dogs just rifle around the water. And I mean, pellets all over the place.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, congratulations on this big win. You know, it's like you said, the first time you felt justice in many, many years in the making.
So, yeah. And also, I just felt it was almost like a perfect storm of having a judge who listened to you and having a super duper legal team from the Rio Grande Legal Aid and having all that evidence. It was just, this all came together. It was amazing. I mean, it's like a phenomenal comet blowing through.
Mm. Yeah, it's a big win. And, you know, you said not easy, but sometimes these actions really do change the game. So,
yeah.
Well, I'm left with something you said earlier that I want to come back to before we close. Just the piece about you have a family with 120 years of history in this place and that the place is like alive for you. And, you know, I think a lot of Americans have lost that kind of connection to place. And when you think about the state of our situation environmentally, you know, sometimes I can't help but wonder if that's not part of the challenge. So what sort of reflections or advice might you have for people to be able to connect more with place, even if they don't have that deep a family lineage, but how people can start building that kind of relationship?
I think all you got to do is start. I think, you know, all you got to do is take the first step, make that first intention. To me, intention is the name of the game. And if you want a connection back with the earth, you just take that first step and have that intention. And I really do believe you have to get out there and do hands-on with the planet. I mean,
you can't sit in an air-conditioned office and discuss it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, you really do. And there is ways, trust me. There are ways. Anybody can figure out ways. But it's the intention to do it. And I always said it's like I used to almost scold environmental groups sometimes. It's because they will talk about the earth being alive and they will talk about Gaia, but it's like they don't trust the planet to move in its own synchronistically alive way. But if you become, realize that it is live, I mean, there's energy there. Mm-hmm. There is real energy there.
You're just known as a, like, what was it? Mother Jones gave you the Hellraiser of the Month award at one point,
oh, yeah,
which I think is such a great phrase. But yeah, that you yourself are a force of nature. And it sounds like nature is giving you the energy to be the force of nature
it
to
is.
Keep doing this work.
It is. Trust yeah. me. It is. It yeah. is.
All right. Well, yeah, thanks again. And, you know, just on a personal level, like, I know I already said it, but really, truly, like, every time in my own career and life and struggle with courage moments, I think of you. And you've been just, I was in a women's group of women activists, and we called ourselves the Unreasonable Women. and so you, even though you work locally in Texas, you've been an inspiration to so many, including myself.
Well, bless your heart. I appreciate that. I really do. That makes my day. It makes me feel good.
Oh,
I don't
good.
Often hear that.
Really? I wish you heard it all the time because I know I'm not alone.
what do they say about a prophet in his own land?
Yeah.
Most of the things, I'm the crazy woman. I'm considered the crazy woman.
Yeah. Well,
you know,
I think you're just the right kind of crazy that the planet needs.
Very nice to hear.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much, Dan, and wish you a wonderful rest of your day and good luck with the rest of this process. I'll be following it on the listservs and all that.
We're going to give them hell. That's
yeah.
what we do.
And if you're ever in Los Angeles, feel free to come say hello.
Yeah. Well, thank you, honey. All right.
Yeah. All right. Take care. Bye. And that's our show. If you like what you're hearing, help spread the word. Subscribe to the Indisposable Podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Add a review, talk us up, try our 5-friend challenge. Share some highlights from today's show with a handful of people in your life who could use an uplift. Nobody spreads a message like you. The Indisposable Podcast is brought to you by Upstream, sparking innovative solutions to plastic pollution, envisioning a world without it, and empowering businesses, communities, and individuals to imagine and co-create this future with us. You can find resources mentioned on today's episode, as well as learn more about Upstream's work at www.upstreamsolutions.org. Follow us on social, support us on Patreon, and join the movement. There's a better way than throwaway.